So I'm talking about bioenergy here today and talking about different cropping systems than we've heard about in some of the previous talks. And when I'm talking about bioenergy, I'm talking about more than ethanol. So I'm talking about bioenergy being getting energy from plant biomass. But I'm talking about biofuels, which would include ethanol, but would also include other bioenergy products that you could make from thermochemical conversion, and then also getting bioenergy from electricity and heat generation, either by burning 100% of biomass and getting electricity from that, or co-firing it with a fossil fuel, such as co-firing it with coal. So we're talking about these three types of bioenergy. And then the cropping system that I'm looking at and talking about, as was mentioned, are prairie systems. And certainly there are other systems that are talked about probably more as far as for bioenergy feedstocks, but I think prairies are a system that it makes a lot of sense to talk about for a variety of reasons. And so some of the reasons I think that it's important we consider prairies as a bioenergy feedstock, first of all, is there's a variety of environmental benefits. And those would include things such as there's reduced soil erosion with prairie systems compared to annual cropping systems, which are the dominant cropping systems in the north central United States. There's less nutrient pollution into water bodies compared to annual systems, and it can help stabilize some of the hydrology of some of these systems because prairies have more roots than annual cropping systems. Also, if you look at it as far as thinking about maybe fossil fuel prices are going to increase or energy prices will increase in the future, growing prairie systems compared to annual systems, they require fewer inputs. And so you require fewer inputs of pesticides, insecticides, also fewer inputs as far as needing fertilizer for the system. And also there's just less management of these systems because they're perennial systems compared to annual systems, and so there's fewer trips over the field with tractors, so less diesel fuel use. So I think in the future, as energy and prices increase, this will become increasingly important. And also for places like the north central United States, where we really are dominated by a very limited number of cropping systems, moving to additional cropping systems for bioenergy process can really increase the diversity we see on the landscape. And that can be at the scale of increasing landscape heterogeneity by having these perennial systems and just having something different than what we have. But also it, of course, increases the plant diversity at that local scale, which then also has been found to increase animal diversity in terms of beneficial insects, wildlife, songbirds, game species that people want to hunt. And so I think for all of these purposes, it's important to consider these prairie systems. And when we talk about prairies, prairies differ from, let's say, a switchgrass stand in that there's diversity in prairie systems. And so what I'm going to talk about today with the prairie systems is functional diversity as opposed to species diversity, which might be more commonly thought of. And so in prairies, when you talk about functional diversity, there are four distinct functional groups in prairies. And those functional groups are cool season grasses, which are C3 grasses, warm season grasses, or C4 grasses. There are forbs, which are also called wildflowers, and then there are legumes. And so those are kind of the four broad classes of prairie diversity, and that's the diversity that I'm going to talk about today. So our research, what we're looking at, is trying to answer the question, does this functional group identity, so what functional groups you have in your prairie, and nitrogen fertilization, how do they affect a prairie's feedstock characteristics, so how that prairie biomass could be converted into a bioenergy product, and then also what would those yields be on the landscape scale. And nitrogen fertilization is included in this study because if you're going to grow a prairie for bioenergy production, there's the potential interest in using nitrogen fertilization as a way of increasing yield. So we're going to look at these prairie systems and look at the effect of functional diversity, but then also as a way of comparing it to kind of the status quo of what more of the research is looking at, we're going to compare these prairie systems to corn stover systems. So how do these feedstock characteristics and bioenergy yields of the prairie systems compare to corn stover feedstock characteristics and bioenergy yields? And the way we're assessing this is we have a field experiment. And the field experiment is a 5x2 incomplete factorial design. So we're looking at three different levels of prairie functional diversity. So we have the cool season or C3 grasses, warm season or C4 grasses, and legumes. So we don't have forbs in this experiment. We have these three functional groups, and then we have a mixture that includes all three of these functional groups. And then we grow those prairie treatments without nitrogen fertilization and with nitrogen fertilization. And then to have that comparison with the corn system, we have just continuous corn that's fertilized and kind of conventionally managed. And so this experiment was, I'm presenting data today from 2008 and 2009. And so what we did is we grew these in the field. At the end of the, we waited till after a hard frost, then we harvested the above ground biomass, and then we processed them to analyze the bioenergy characteristics. So for the feedstock characteristics that we measured, we looked at cell wall concentration, hemicellulose, cellulose, and ash concentrations. And then we also looked at the ethanol conversion ratio, so how effectively would it be converted into ethanol. And for that, what I'm presenting here today is the theoretical maximum ethanol yield. So because there's not a lot of commercial cellulosic, there aren't commercial cellulosic bioenergy conversion, this is the maximum ethanol you could get from these treatments. And then higher heating values, so how much energy is contained in the plant biomass. And all of this is on a per gram basis, so just within the biomass, how could it be converted into bioenergy? And then what I'm going to present today is looking at these all in relation to one another from a principal components analysis. And then for the bioenergy yields, we looked at, first of all, what is biomass? So how much above ground biomass do you get from these different systems? And then does how does that, plus the ethanol conversion ratio and the higher heating value, how do those translate into ethanol yields and energy yields on a per hectare basis? So in terms of how much stuff do you get from these systems as far as ethanol or energy? So to look at the feedstock characteristics, this is the principal component analysis by plot. Anywhere you see those triangles, that's from a fertilized treatment. The rectangles are from an unfertilized treatment. The closed symbols are from the 2008, and the open symbols are from 2009. And so the first thing that I'd like to say that's not on this figure, but we did the analyses on, so whether or not the different prairie treatments received nitrogen fertilization or not, that did not affect any of the feedstock characteristics. So the main effect of the feedstock characteristics was on the different functional group the different functional groups present. And there also was an effect on what year the plants were grown, which is consistent with other studies. And so on these two axes, we describe more than 99% of the variability in the data. If we look at these six bioenergy the feedstock characteristics, high cell wall concentrations and high ethanol yields loaded positively on axis one. There was a positive relationship between having high heating values and high cellulose concentration, and that loaded positively on axis two. And then there was a negative association with these two, with the higher heating value and cellulose, and high ash and high hemicellulose concentrations were also negatively associated with axis two and were positively associated with one another. And so if we look at the different functional groups and how that overlays on the different feedstock characteristics, you can see that the legumes are very distinct from all of the other treatments that had the grasses in it. And the legumes are really characterized by having very high heating values and high cellulose concentrations. Then within all the treatments that contain grasses, you can see that the warm season grasses, the C4 grasses over here, tended to cluster really tightly and were very highly associated with having high theoretical ethanol conversion ratios. If you look at the mixtures and the C3 grasses that circle around here, you can see that those are not distinct from one another, which when we planted the mixtures, we planted them in equal densities of all the three functional groups, but the C3 grasses came to dominate the mixtures, and so it makes sense that they're not separated here because what we see in the field is actually mixtures that are dominated by C3 grasses. So those feedstock characteristics are dominant by the dominant plant in that treatment. And so the C3 grasses and mixtures are much more spread out than, let's say, the C4 grasses, but they tend to be associated with having high ash concentrations and high hemicellulose concentrations. And then the corn, which, you know, we only have the fertilized corn, you can see that it was very different between 2008 and 2009, which has been found in other literature that it's variable over years, but was generally associated with high ethanol yields and high hemicellulose concentrations. And so if we take these feedstock characteristics and then look at what we would get as far as yields, the first thing to look at is what is the above-ground productivity. So this is the above-ground biomass that we harvested from the fields, dry weight biomass in megagrams per hectare over the different treatments. We averaged the data over 2008 and 2009. And so unlike the feedstock characteristics where nitrogen fertilization did not have an effect, nitrogen fertilization had a very strong effect on the total amount of above-ground biomass produced. And so if you fertilize the treatments with nitrogen, you got more above-ground biomass. And you can see then within the letters represent differences among the treatments. So let's say within the fertilized treatments, the C4 grasses were the most productive, followed by the C3 grasses, mixtures, and corn stover. When nitrogen fertilization was not used, there was no difference in above ground biomass between the C4 grasses and the mixtures, and they were the most productive. So if we take this yield data and then combine that with the feedstock characteristics, this is a figure of your estimated ethanol yields, and again, these are theoretical maxima, and your estimated energy yields. So we've got ethanol yields in liters of ethanol per hectare for the different treatments averaged over the 2 years, and energy yields, gigajoules of energy contained in that plant biomass over the 5 different treatments. And so you can see that these look very similar to the biomass yields. And so what we're seeing here as far as ethanol yields and energy yields is driven very strongly by how much biomass is there on the field, more so than what were the different feedstock characteristics of the different functional groups. And so again, you can see that when you fertilized it, the ethanol yields and the energy yields were highest in the warm season grasses, or the C4 grasses, followed by the other treatments that had grasses in them, including the corn stover, which is a grass. And then when you didn't fertilize it, either the C4 grasses were the most productive as far as ethanol or energy yield, or they were the same as the different mixture treatments. So if we want to look at this and then think of, okay, what are conclusions we can draw from this? Both functional group identity and nitrogen fertilization were important when we were looking at bioenergy yields. But if we're really focused on the feedstock characteristics, which an engineer might be really interested in trying to do the conversion technology and how these feedstocks will actually convert into a bioenergy product, then functional group is really important and nitrogen fertilization is much less important. But if we're looking at how much total product can we get off the landscape, then understanding the nitrogen fertilization effect and the functional group identity, both of those were really important in determining those bioenergy yields. And if we want to compare this to the corn stover, the bioenergy characteristics, and specifically the feedstock characteristics of corn stover, were very similar to that of the C4 grasses, which certainly makes sense because corn is a C4 grass. And so if you were trying to optimize a bioenergy process, the C4 grasses, which were the most productive, are also very similar to the corn, which a lot of research is happening on. So I think as far as thinking about this, as far as utilizing prairies for bioenergy production, a take-home message is that both the functional group and nitrogen fertilization they're both important if you are determining the quantity and the quality of bioenergy products. So with that, I'd just like to thank the funding sources and then the folks that have helped in the field and laboratory, and open it up for any questions if there's time. I'm in the back.
Both years, were those the establishment years, or is 2009 the second full year after establishment?
That's a good point. Okay, so with prairie systems, there's an establishment year. What we did in this experiment, which I didn't say, is I transplanted seedlings so that then they established the first year. So I kind of avoided the establishment year, and what happened in 2008 looked very similar to what happened in 2009 because I used the seedlings. But if you were doing this on a commercial scale, you'd have to use seeds and you'd have an establishment year. But in this experiment, we avoided that by transplanting seedlings.
And a follow-up question on that. You haven't talked about the composition of the mixtures over time. And there's a fair amount of literature that says the moment you stick nitrogen into a system, your species composition is going to change.
Yes.
Tillman hasn't produced enough of that.
Yes.
We're not talking about this. So over time, your functional yields will change.
Yes. And certainly we have that data. And that is a very important point out, because you do see it started out with maximum functional group evenness. We had equal of all three functional groups. When you fertilize it, and especially because we fertilized it early in the year, the C3 grasses come up early in the year, we're driving it to C3 grasses, whereas when you don't fertilize it, the mixtures are staying much more homogeneous as far as what we planted them at. And so, right, the diversity is a very important point. I do think that one useful thing, if we could understand how the functional groups differ as far as the feedstock characteristics, then as long as you would go out and survey a prairie and say, okay, it's 75% C3 grasses, It's probably going to have high ash. It's probably going to have high hemicellulose. Maybe it would be better for this type of conversion process, whereas if you know you have a C4 grass-dominated prairie, okay, maybe that would be better for this type of bioenergy. But I do, there is a very strong effect of the fertilization on the prairie diversity, and we are tracking that, and that is an important piece of this. Yes?
I would be more worried about my phosphorus than I would my nitrogen.
So we are tracking phosphorus, and we're tracking how much we're removing. These are agricultural soils in Iowa. They're very high phosphorus, and they had been farmed in the past and managed with phosphorus management. So right now, certainly phosphorus is not a limiting factor. The nitrogen is the limiting factor as far as yields. But certainly in lower phosphorus areas, that could be an issue. And certainly if you just continue to remove phosphorus over time and then you don't track it or replace it, then it could become an issue. In these cases, it happens to be very high in our soils.
And we have several other presenters.
Yes, any questions of anyone?
Well,
so. Yeah, in the back, sir.
Was that complete removal of the stover, so 100% removal of stover, considered in?
It's a hand harvest, but so it is to about 2 centimeters off the ground. So, yes, more than you would probably harvest with a mechanical harvest.
And did that include the cob as well, or just stover?
Yes, for the corn, it included the stover. Or, I mean, all of the stover, including the cob.
But not the grain.
But not the grain. And I didn't present the grain yields here. And, of course, we do have those. And if you look at these systems and you include the corn grain, there's a reason, let's say in Iowa, we grow corn because it's very, very productive. You know, so when you include the grain, the corn systems, certainly as far as above ground productivity, are the most productive. I don't know. Any other questions?
Your results indicate that legumes are better for firing, like burning. Is that because of the composition of the sedan?
Yes, and so what you see with the legumes, and so anecdotally I can say this, the legumes drop their leaves when they're senescing, so I think the very nitrogen-rich leaves fall to the ground, and the stems are very woody, so you get these very woody stems that then have high heating values, but they're very low yielding. You know, so you have these sticks sticking out of the ground, but very low yielding, but per gram of biomass, they have a very high heating value, but when you take into account their low yield, then they're not productive in that sense.
And they're not good for ethanol production. Because they have too much cellulose?
Lignin. I didn't present lignin values here. I mean, I think they're high lignin. They're very woody, and so they would be better for burning than converting into ethanol because the lignin would inhibit the, like a biochemical conversion type process. In the front.
The variety that you use for the legume, I mean, there are those that are being developed for ethanol production that are different, use a traditional alfalfa, or what variety did you use?
So I used all native prairie species, and I didn't say this, but like the C3 grass was a mix of 3 different native prairie C3 grasses. So the legume was a mix of 3 different legumes. It was Illinois bundleflower, showy tick trefoil, and Lespediza round-headed bush clover. And so these are native prairie legumes, so no breeding, no improvement, no. In the back.
What was the rationale to wait first, if you understand that conversion rates are going to be influenced by the composition, why wait until the first killing frost to determine total biomass?
So that's a good point. So certainly peak biomass would happen in somewhere in August, and we waited till after a killing frost. And so we are looking at these in the context of bioenergy. And so with them being perennials, they'll translocate nitrogen to their roots. And so then we don't have to harvest that off the field, which as far as for bioenergy, the nitrogen is undesirable, but keeping it in the field is desirable agronomically. And then also the P and K, I don't know the amount of P and K that get returned to the soil, but there is some leaching of the P and K back to the soil at the end of the growing season. So we were trying to minimize the nutrient concentrations in the biomass. But of course, that does come at some expense of the total amount of biomass you get. But for a bioenergy context, it seems most likely people would harvest the biomass after a hard frost, so you could leave the maximum amount of nutrients on the field and also then not be toting them to a bioenergy plant that would count them as a waste product.
I can understand why the peak biomass of native species would happen during August, but if you manipulated the system just to delay that, In other words, they're reaching peak biomass before corn is. But if you delayed it by later maturing species of some sort, would it increase the productivity?
As far as what you would harvest post-senescence?
Well, you have a month, basically, of good growing weather that you don't use.
So the prairies compared to a corn system, I mean, the prairies use, and I don't have this data on me, but as far as the growing season, the prairies use maybe 2 months more of the growing season than the corn as far as they're accumulating biomass when the corn is either hasn't been planted or is already senesced. So the prairies use more of the growing season. But for a bioenergy product, you would want to harvest dry biomass also. So it's probably going to be in your best interest to wait until at least later in the growing season when you're not harvesting a lot of nutrients and you're not harvesting wet biomass because you don't want to bring wet biomass to a biorefinery either. I mean, because it's just more, you know, then you're hauling it and it's more energy.
And if you harvested earlier when the nutrients hadn't been translocated back into the root system, you probably decreased the lifespan of the perennial.
Yes.
As well.
Yes. They've showed that. I saw some good presentations with switchgrass where they were showing if they harvested in the middle of the year, the next year they had foxtail barley was a whole stand because it really knocked the switchgrass back. So some of these, if you harvest them, it's certainly if you repeatedly harvested them during the growing season at the same time, it would really knock the plants back because they have evolved with kind of sporadic grazing as opposed to, you know, continual cutting during the growing season.
So the final harvest, what height did you did all of them, basically ground level?
Yes.
Because like on your warm season grasses, I think that would be hard on the stand.
Yes.
Even the following year.
Yes. So, and we have another experiment where so these are all small plots of the prairie plots because we did the transplants to speed up the establishment. The plots are 2 meters by 2 meters. We have another experiment where they're 0.4 acre plots. And so on those plots, we harvest them at about 8 inches because, and you can see it in these plots, it did really hurt them. They were being cut too close to the ground, and it was hard on the plants for their overwintering. Especially, I think, the winter of 2008, it was just a harder winter, and there was not a nice snow layer to insulate the plants. And so, yes, I wouldn't recommend harvesting it that close to the ground for bioenergy production just for stand maintenance because it is really hard on the stand. So you would get less biomass than that than if you were actually harvesting it in the back.
How much nitrogen did you put?
So these, we were managing them. We wanted the corn and the prairie systems to be the same, so we were managing them for optimal corn yield. And so we started out with 150 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare, so high nitrogen rates. And in 2008 in Iowa, we had flooding. And so then when we did the late spring nitrate test to see what our recommendations for corn fertilization were, we had lost nitrogen from the system either through denitrification or leaching. So in 2008, we added an additional 40 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare. So they received a lot of, these fertilized prairies received a lot of nitrogen fertilization. But we do have a similar study going on where we're giving the prairie, I think, about 80 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare. And you certainly wouldn't need to fertilize as high as 150 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare. Even, I think, you know, 80 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare on a prairie is kind of on the high side. So yeah, these were very high nitrogen rates, but optimal for corn production.
Did you buy, by going late in the harvest, you know, after the first one crop, by cutting low, are you overestimating the contribution of the seed tree grasses in your total mix at the end? Because if the reality is it's going to be that you're going to have to cut higher to maintain your warm season C4s, the C3s petered out somewhere in July, and part of that biomass is going to collapse by the time the first kind of crop comes around. Aren't you skewing your results right now?
So this is just anecdotal, but I would say anecdotally it might go the opposite way. So I think the really harvesting it very close to the ground was very hard on the C3 grasses, maybe more so than the warm season grasses, because the Canada wild rye was one of the more dominant cool season grasses that we had, and its crowns are a little bit more above ground than some of the warm season grasses. Just, I mean, when I'm looking at it, that's what it looks like, and so I think I damaged the cool season grass crowns maybe slightly more than I think part of it is damage to the crowns or getting it too close to those crowns so they can't overwinter. So this is just anecdotally from kind of looking at the plants, but I don't think we skewed it strongly to the C3 grasses as far as with our harvesting. Certainly fertilizing in the spring is helping our C3 grasses preferentially compared to the C4 grasses. Yeah, thank you. It's nice to get a lot of questions, but thank you for staying the extra time.